Already know, come on, man. Hey, you're listening to the baddest buzz, Studio W, the Buzz, your global radio network. Hey, we circle this thing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In case you didn't know, that was intro, love thing. And now it's time for the Soul Savage Show, Soul Savage Radio with Q Lynn Green and Whitney.
I'm on an interview.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, well, what's going on, man?
Man, you're back. Jamming. Oh, my goodness. That's a bad jam. Intro.
Oh, yeah.
Slamming.
Yeah, for sure. It's from one of my favorite groups of all time. When I think of intros, it's, like I've said before about a couple of artists from the 90s, but when I hear intros music, it just, it's like quintessential 90s. Like, when you define an era, like, that's that group for me. And what we got on the line right now, our special guest that we have on now, he's a part of this amazing ensemble of R&B singers, slash songwriter. Like I said before, intro, they had top Billboard R&B hits. You heard Love Thang. They had Don't Leave Me, Ribbon in the Sky, you know. Once you get blessed by Stevie Wonder, it's like you're that group. You can't say nothing after that. But I want to introduce our special guest, singer-songwriter, the amazing, the incomparable Mr. Buddy White. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing great. You are so kind with your words. Thank you for the kind words. Appreciate you.
No problem, man. It's a pleasure. No problem at all. It's a pleasure to have you on. And what I want to do right here, I want to get right to it. We get right to it on this show. We get to the, my portion, I like to get to the, I call it the musical genesis of the artist's background. So I want to go back to your childhood upbringing in terms of music. Was there any, what was it particular about certain music that you were drawn to growing up?
Well, growing up, I played the piano in the Baptist church because my father was a musician in the church. He played the organ, and I had a chance to sit at the piano. And some of my first interactions with R&B music was The Barge because it sounded like gospel. And mm-hmm. then another song was like the Lionel Richie and Diana Ross Endless Love record that kind of just started drawing me towards rhythm and blues music. And that's pretty much my beginning of like trying to figure out rhythm and blues music, you know, pulling away from my gospel roots to starting to create rhythm and blues music. Once I heard those records, being that I was a piano player, I started to try to create music that sounded like those records. Yep.
And getting to that, was there a particular artist or musician, like you said, DeBarge, but was there any singer in particular, like when you heard their voice, you were like, that's music when you first heard them?
James Ingram.
Oh, wow.
James Ingram, Layla Hathaway. When I heard them, I was like, that's music right there. Because their voices sound like instruments. Like the purity, the, you know. Yeah, it's like James Ingram, Anita Baker, Layla Hathaway. Those were like my three people that inspired me. Of course, Stevie Wonder, he inspired everybody. But like not like, you know, thinking about it and going outside of the box. It was Layla Hathaway, Anita Baker, and James Ingram. The obvious are Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, you know, people like that.
Right.
But those three right there made me want to sing. Like when I blew up my first car, I had the cassette in my car and I was singing and driving. Yep.
In terms of that era growing up, what was it that you noticed growing up in terms of the way music, because during that time, I guess, it was a lot of groups like the Barges and, Switch, all those different kind of groups. Were you always wanting to be a part of a group, growing up, or was it just something that happened?
Actually, I wanted to be a rapper. Like from playing the piano in church, because I was in a rap group in church. When I was playing the piano in church, J-Ru the Damager, we went to the same church in East New York, Brooklyn. So we put together a rap group, and we wanted to be like a rap group. It wasn't until I was in the Army in North Carolina that I met Kenny Green, who introduced me to R&B music. And that's when I was like, yeah, I think, you know, we could do this on the R&B level. But prior to meeting Kenny Green, the lead singer, God bless his soul, rest in peace, rhythm and blues really wasn't like my calling. I felt like God had a vision for me to be successful in music. I didn't know if it was going to be country, house music, rap music, or whatever, but I knew I was preparing myself to do something in the music industry, you know, as far as an entertainer. And it was just pretty much down to whatever opportunity presented itself. If somebody would have presented me with a gospel contract, then I would have been a gospel singer. If it would have been a country contract, I would have been a gospel singer. Because, first of all, I'm a musician, and, you know, I think that's how it would have happened. But I'm so blessed and thankful that I met Kenny in the Army, and we did this R&B thing.
Right. That's actually part of one of my questions too, but I'll wait for that one. In terms of like, what age were you when you started taking it serious? Was it meeting Kenny Green or was it beforehand?
I've been a paid musician since I was like 12 years old. Like when I started playing the piano in church, they were paying me to do music there. And at that point I was like, wow, I could make money from doing something that I love. And, you know, it was the love that kept driving me. So there were times when I was making money and there were times that I wasn't making money. And, you know, either being a producer, because I had started producing hip hop tracks for people and stuff when I was in the Army. And I think it was in my 20s, like when I was 25, after we had the Mary J. Blige records and stuff, and we started seeing, like, real, like, money from making music, that I was like, wow. You know, so I would say, to answer your question, I would be like at 25, around 25, I knew that I could make a living doing music.
And just to get on back to the church a little bit, I want to get on that just a few more minutes. But in terms of, because you played in church, you played the piano, you played the organ too, you said?
I pretty much played, I could play the organ or the piano, but a lot of times they was, my father was on the organ, so I would just sit on the piano and just
come up with. So when you were playing gospel, when you were playing the music in church, was there any, I always tie church with musical discipline. Was there anything in terms of church, did you think the repetitiveness of playing in church helped you musically discipline to get ready for what you were about to get into in terms of the music industry?
But after I started playing in church, once I went into the military, it had been like 5 years passed before I even touched the piano again.
So oh, wow.
It was almost like in the past for me. And that's when I met Kenny Green, and that's when I started back on the piano, and we got into the R&B. So even though I feel like in my heart that it was destined to happen, there was a time when I wasn't doing music at all, and I wasn't like playing the piano and stuff, and I was just in the Army. I had been deployed to the Gulf War. They sent me to like Iraq and Saudi Arabia and all these other, you know, places and stuff. So I was in the real Army. I know a lot of people say they was in the Army, but I was in the real Army. I was in the 82nd Airborne Division. I was a paratrooper jumping out of planes and the whole nine. So that kind of like tied me up mentally away from my music and stuff. But once I got back from the war and I linked back up with Kenny, I knew that music was the only thing that I wanted to do.
And so with that started, what was the groundwork of intro? Was that how it all started, with you and Kenny meeting each other in the Army? Was that part of it?
That was definitely the beginning of it. Me meeting Kenny and at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and we going to the rec center. Me playing the piano and him writing out lyrics. Us coming up to New York, going into the studio. Someone just putting in our ear that, hey, you guys sound good. You should try to get a record deal. And then us moving forward and getting a record deal. Like, actually, we had two record deals before the first release of the intro album. We had a deal with a label called Classified. Then we signed with Untouchables as artists to their production company, and they signed us to Atlantic Records. Then Atlantic Records signed us directly to them. But shout out to Heavy D for introducing us to Eddie F. And I gotta say one more thing. I can't continue this interview without saying rest in peace to my dude Prince Marky D from the Fat Boys, who passed away today. God bless your soul. He's a good guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, man. Yep. Rest in peace.
Jeez, you just told me something new because I had been on the internet. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Prince Marky D passed away today.
Rest on to him. Yeah, that was another part of it, because I read on that Eddie F. Is it, how did that... that relationship started terms with Eddie F. How did that come about?
Yeah, we met Heavy D at a club called the Red Zone, and Heavy D, we sung for Heavy D at the Red Zone. We told him that we were driving out to the club and we were listening to his music on the way out to the club, and we sang the song that we were listening to, and he called us like 2 weeks later and told us if it's possible, could we come back to New York and meet with Eddie F. And once we met with Eddie F., you know, it's probably like within a week or two, he put us in the studio with Jeff Redd, Father MC, Don Head, Mary J. Blige, you know, all of the artists that they were working on. That's how we be.
So all Uptown artists?
Uptown was some epic. It was all, you know, because John Head, he was signed to Epic. But Mary they were signed Uptown. Yep.
Okay. In terms of were you writing? Were you just writing for them and producing, or what was the?
Just writing. We were just writing.
Okay.
We were putting songs together for our album, for what we thought was our album. We didn't know where these records were going to end up. And we were just going in with the producers like Dave Hall, Novell Hodge, DJ Eddie F, Dan Whittington, Kenny Cornegay, like the Untouchables producers. We would go over to their studios and do the records. And then at that time we knew that it could end up on our album, but a lot of times it was like, this song is going to this album right here. This song is going to this album. Like in the instance of Mary J. Blige, we did Reminisce, My Love, Love No Limit, and Let Me Be the One for Mary. But she only needed three records as opposed to four. So Let Me Be the One we kept for ourselves, and she got Love No Limit, My Love, and, then we did a You Don't Have to Worry for the User, Who's the Man soundtrack for her as well, and Reminisce.
We just
would write songs, and you know it would be up to the A&Rs, the heads, and they'd be like, "Oh, I think this could fit so and so. I think this could fit so and so."
So it was demo. Did y'all actually were in the studio with them, or was y'all just demoed it and then the A&R got it?
We demoed the records originally with intro voices, and then we would always be in the studio with the artists when they performed them as well. So with like Mary and Chris and the Winies and all those people, we would actually be in the recording room with the engineers and producers and stuff, doing what they call now like vocal coaching, just to make sure that the lyrics were placed correct and stuff.
Shout out to Kenny, man, because he's not the
voice's opinion. Shout out to him. It was like pretty much him doing everything, and you know he brought me along with him. You know what I'm saying? So I'm sitting here pretty much talking like it's me doing all these things, but I was pretty much the fly on the wall, you know what I'm saying? So I got to give credit where it's due. Shout out to Kenny Green. You know, he gave me a lot of money for being there and all of that stuff. But as far as the creative side, you know what I'm saying, I know I would not have been here had it not been for him. And he's not here today to speak for himself, but I'm going to let y'all know.
Oh, that's you're getting on exactly where I was going, because that's what I was going to talk about in terms of the writing and how you were saying how y'all first started. You would play on the chords and Kenny would come with his parts. In terms of the creative process of how y'all wrote y'all songs, I know you say he did bulk of the work, but what was it like working with him? How was his genius at first glance?
Like, Love No Limit was written, and that song, Love No Limit, was written in, like, 1 hour.
Wow.
Like, 1 hour, Love Without a Limit was written. Like, it didn't take him more than, if he spent more than an hour writing a song, then we just really didn't pay attention to the song anymore. He was really quick with the pen. Really quick. It's like he had these stories already in his head, and you know, all he needed was the music and the direction for it to go. And, you know, we always brag about, you taught me how to write and sing. That's what I used to tell him. Then he'd be like, you taught me how to play the piano. We just had, like, a really dope relationship. Like, stuff that he had, I didn't have. And I felt like things that I had, he didn't have. But at the end of the day, you know, the chemistry of intro, we really started out, like, Kenny was going to be the songwriter. I was going to be the producer. And Jeff was going to be, like, the choreographer. And that was like our whole chemistry right there.
And in terms of those songs, who was it? You said you were just a fly on the wall when those records were made. What was it like being in the studio and seeing those artists that y'all were doing the music for, like Mary J. Blige and Jeffrey? Like, what was it like watching them do the songs that y'all were helped create?
I mean, it was really just like a regular intro session. honestly, it's like just a really intro session. Like, yo, buddy, go in and do this part right here. Okay, boom, I'm in here. I'm doing the melody line. I'm laying out. We got a lot of backgrounds on the 411 album. So we'll sit down and write. With Mary, it was pretty much just like a cookout. Every session was like a cookout. We just get together, and we spend a lot of time together in the studio just hanging out and just talking. We might spend the whole day together just hanging out before the mic even comes on. You know what I'm saying? Just like just for that vibe. And that was the whole, how Eddie F. had the whole situation set up at the Playground. That was the name of the studio in New Jersey. And at the Playground on any given day, you know, might have Donnell Jones there. Heavy D might be by. Andre Harrell might be stopping by on his way home from work. It was just like a modern day Motown, what was going on. Puffy actually lived there for a little bit. So it was like a modern day Motown.
And just, I just stay on that because I feel like those records, I know people listening in, they may not know all this background, and I like to stay on just the history of the songwriting and production because a lot of people don't understand the process of how these records are made. So if to the people listening in, if you hear me harping on this, I'm trying to give him the opportunity to paint the picture of how these records were made because these were all classic hits. The songs that he's naming, the What's the 411 album is like a pinnacle of a masterpiece album for a debut album. And he's, Mr. Buddy White is a part of that history. So I just wanted to just highlight your contribution to that and as well as Kenny Green. Cause to me, you were talking about it, James, and again, rest on to the amazing Kenny Green, but I was always a fan of his writing, not just with intro, because we're going to get on that too, as well. We're going to talk about the group's history, but I wanted to get into the sort of how y'all came up, how y'all first started in terms of the What's the 411. When I hear those records, when I hear Love Note Limit, it's like I can hear, because I feel like certain songwriters have their style, and I feel like Kenny Green, like he had, like when I hear his record on What's the 411, like I know that's the Kenny Green record, like whenever you play Mary, My Life, and Big Bub wrote on that as well, on the My Life album, and I can hear his songwriting style. And so I can hear Kenny's, I can hear y'all influence on those records. So, and just a couple more on the What's the 411, that whole project, in terms of what y'all added to that album, what was it, what, in terms of how y'all got that record to be what it was, how much, was there a lot of effort for Mary to do that record, or was it about the same with Kenny in terms of how she did her takes?
Those records were effortless. Those records were effortless. It was just like, here we go, boom, let's get it. And she just sang it, like, we didn't have to go to the studio two or three times. Like, all of those records were recorded on the first take in the studio. Like, Mary got the record, she heard it, she listened to it. She might have just listened to it on the way to the studio. I really don't know how many times she listened to it, but I know once she showed up at the studio, she already knew what she had to do. She came in and she recorded the songs. We didn't have to book multiple sessions for her to get the records correct. You know, she had like photo memory as far as doing vocals and stuff.
Wow.
And this was the time right after the Real Love record was already on the radio, and the Father MC record was on the radio, but the album wasn't out yet. And Puffy used to bring her to the studio. We was like, let's get it, man. Let's go. You know, we didn't know that she would be Mary J. Blige. What's the 411? At that time, we knew that she was a female working in the studio, and just like we put the best that we had into our very first album, the intro album, we put the very best that we had into Mary J. Blige, the very best that we had into Shinehead, the very best that we had into Jeff Red, the very best that we had into whoever that we would work with at that time. So that was just us at the time. We were so hungry and wanting to be the best, you know what I'm saying? Given the opportunity, we knew that we wanted to do our best. Not be the best, because we've never felt, even to today, I know Intro's not the best that has ever done it, but we wanted to do the best that we could to leave a legacy of music.
Wow. And my next question, it actually follows up with that in terms of Intro, your first debut album came out in 1993, self-titled album Intro, 1993. I know you were talking, when you were talking about some of the demos, and you were saying one of the songs was supposed to be Marriage, but it ended up being Let Me Be the One on that album. Was there a lot of, was it already records that y'all were working on together and it just came about? Like, how was that? I know you said you had, y'all had an album, but what was it that made that album? Did y'all know, like, certain songs that y'all were going to use for another album, or was it just like, did y'all have a plan going out, or was it just how they, Atlantic came up with your first album?
Now, we were just recording songs. We recorded about 30 plus songs on the album, and it was on one day that we were standing on the back porch at Eddie F's house, and we were working with a reggae artist that day, Supercat, and we was on the back porch hanging out with Supercat, Eddie F, and I believe Dave Hall was there, and we were like, Eddie F just started playing some of the Intro records that we had recorded. And it was actually Supercat that picked the records for our first album. So he was like, it's crazy as that is. It's like a reggae artist pretty much picked our very first album, the songs that were on there. Of course, the A&Rs at the label, shout out to Kevin Willie, they had to agree upon it. But it was on that day that we was hanging out with Supercat that we picked the songs for that first album. Yeah.
That is amazing. And when I tell you, that album is sequenced, like, perfectly. And it's like,
it's a clean house album.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's rare. Like, you find certain songs, like, usually the single is supposed to indicate how the album is. But I feel like y'all's first album just pushed that, like, completely to the next level. Because every song, like, even the hit singles, like, besides that, like, the album cut, like, all of it sequenced perfectly to where, yeah, you clean your house to it, but it's, like, an all-around record, and most of the time you don't get those with first debut albums. Like, I feel like Intro's first album stands out because it just all cohesively makes sense. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like a track is out of place, or it's a filler track, or they just threw it on the album just because it feels like it was, like, deliberate in terms of the songs and, again, like, the way it's sequenced, like, Love Thang, Let Me Be the One, Anything for You, like, all those, like, flow in and out of each other to where it's like you just go on to the next track. It's like you're not skipping it. It's just played all the way through. And I know you said Dave Hall, what was it in terms of that chemistry? What was it that made, because when I hear these records, like the way they're all written and produced, it's like all melodic, and it's all like the production stands out and the vocals stand out, but what was it that you feel makes an Intro record, like when you did Let Me Be the One and Love Thang? What was it in terms of that genius that made y'all records pop like that?
Just keeping it simple and keeping it easy, driving to the producer's house. It's just a regular Volkswagen Jetta, which we had at the time, and being humble and listening to them play the simple chords and music and coming with our simple lyrics that people could sing along songs, nothing difficult where people had to reach to learn to sing them and stuff like that. We made records that people could sing to, you know. Like, if you couldn't sing, you could sing an Intro song. And that's pretty much our strategy, just linking that with hip-hop. We paid a lot of homage and paid a lot of attention to, like, the gospel groups, like Take Six and Commission, to structure our harmonies for our records. But we kind of pretty much just kept it simple. You know, driving up to Mount Vernon on snowy nights and going into Dave Hall's house, Nevada Hodges' house, and sitting in there living rooms, not their living rooms, but like their music rooms, and just making music. You know, nothing was planned out. Nobody put Jeff, Kenny, and Buddy together. No label put us together. No auditions or anything. We just went in and, you know, did intro. And being that it was organic, it was organically created, that's how we were able to build our fan base, just organically. Because I think people could feel the realness in us, you know.
Yes. And I think it's hard for me to pick my favorite song from y'all first debut album. But if I had to, it's, I think the ones that you co-wrote on, the Anything For You, that one is definitely my top favorite. And then I want to say it's a tie between...
Don't leave.
Don't leave. I was
going to
say that one.
That's coming on June 4th. Yes. You know, we probably not going to even hit on this because you don't know, but on June 4th, we're releasing a documentary with Indiflix Films, intro,
wow,
music, life, and lyrics, story of Jeff, Kenny, and Buddy, and we're going to have a new album out on Warner Music Group on June 4th, and Don't Leave Me is going to be that single off of that album.
That's amazing. I was definitely about to hit on that, because it's like, for me, when you were talking about that, it always, that album and both of those albums, I think both of y'all's albums always had that gospel in terms of the piano arrangement, because to me, I feel like that was the center of every song in terms of the bass. Like, you got the sort of hip-hop edge to it as well, but the core of it was always, it always had a gospel feel. And I was thinking Commission. So when you said Commission, I was like, that aligned with what I was thinking about. 'Cause that's what I felt like contemporary gospel, those chords were always resonant of, I feel like they always tied together. 'Cause it all comes from the same source. It's just a matter of trading off the influence. But yeah, definitely Don't Leave Me, but it was, I was thinking of Ecstasy of Love. It wasn't Coming Too Fast of Love, but it's a tie between those ballads, like the slow joints, like, I was thinking of that as well. But yeah, it's a tie between those two, and So Many Reasons is definitely one of my top.
Janelle Parker,
from there.
Parker produced Ecstasy of Love, and we kind of had an issue getting that record on it, because, the album was done. So that's why it's not on the cassette. But it's
right.
On the
CD,
but
yes.
nobody would know that Ecstasy, you know, that cassettes were.
I remember that. Because I'm taking it way back. Because I had, we had it on cassette tape. And I remember that. Because I remember not being on there.
Yep.
That's what's so crazy about it.
Ecstasy of Love was a bonus.
Wow. Song. Yes. Oh my God. You get me different excited, because you just blew my mind with that. Because I was like, that wasn't on there. You just made me think that. That's crazy. But I'm going to go to the second album. I feel like during the 90s, it was sort of a precedent. I think it was just like an unspoken rule in terms of, I don't think in any genre terms, I just feel like if you were an artist or a group that came out, like your sophomore album had to follow your debut album. And I feel like that was just the precedent. Like, if your sophomore album, I feel like y'all sophomore album was just as good as the debut. And I think I saw the growth in it. I think during that time period, like, if I think it was like 2 years between those two albums, right? I think
you feel much different than I do. I feel like the second album didn't lead people that were checking for the first album, people that bought the first album, I don't think the second album led them to where, like, if you bought the second album, I don't think it was what you was expecting. I think people that bought the second album was expecting a follow-up from the first album. But the thing with the second album was Kenny's dad passed away when we got the budget to go in and do the second album. And Atlantic Records, off of the success of the first album, they're like, oh, give these guys what they want. They gave us something like $600,000 to record that second album. But the thing was, we could have did whatever we wanted to do to record that album, but Kenny's father had passed away. So that was the pin right here. Like, on the first album, I had just came back from the war. So I was able to, that was my outlet right there. I was able to write, you know, I own the majority of the publishing on Come Inside and stuff like that. But that was my outlet. So on the second album, like Kenny had a crisis. So boom, we had to, you know, be respectful and like, yo, let's go. Let's get it off, man. So the majority of New Life is pretty much about the passing of Kenny's dad. And also, as we learned later on, that it may have been some personal things about himself as well. But the difference between the first album and the second album, you won't hear my New York City influence on that second album as much as far as the hip hop,
right.
For R&B and stuff. You're gonna hear more of a gospel type of flow on it.
Yeah, that is
my album. I love New Life. I listen to it all the time.
Yeah, that was mostly my point in terms of the difference. I can hear the difference between both of those albums. I think when I think back to that time period, I think all that played a part into where it fell on the charts. I think it did well, but it could have done better. I think people were probably looking for those same, like, the love thing, those Let Me Be the One, those, like, Come Inside, like, those top joints, and I think they were all, like, solid. All the singles, all the songs off New Life were all replayable. I mean, it was all, like, it was all resonant, but I think in terms of how mainstream views, like, certain music, it had to meet
also,
the same.
A lot of it had to do with the promotion coming out of Atlantic as well. Because they didn't really push the New Life album because
I definitely get that, because you can feel that. I'm like, it's at least three, especially what you won't do for love. Like, if not those three, at least that one, that would have definitely
When you watch the documentary, you'll learn why we did What You Won't Do for Love. And I just learned it when I watched the second cut. I never knew that was Kenny's mother's favorite song, and that's why he requested for us to do What You Won't Do for Love. That whole New Life album was strictly for his family. You want that, Clay? You want that?
Wow. That's insane. And you're talking about this album, and I feel like it's a lot of different. You're speaking of that documentary, and it's other ones that I've heard with certain R&B groups in terms of their second album. It's always that hold up with some A&R rep that basically, you know, just drops the ball. And I feel like in terms of after that album, what was the game plan after that? Or what was the move after, from what your perspective is on it, what was the game plan for y'all after that album dropped and you didn't feel like it did what it was supposed to because of the A&R rep? What was the game move for intro as a group after that? You, Jeff, and Kenny, what was the game plan after that album?
Just to do as much touring as we can off of it and see what was next. Because at that point, we were no longer signed to Untouchables. We were signed directly to Atlantic Records. So it was pretty much how long this guy was going to work there was pretty much how long we was going to be in that flow. But unfortunately, in the middle of the New Life album, you know, we weren't really happy with what was going on with the direction that we were going and stuff. And we let that be known and stuff like that. And it ended up pretty much, people use the word drop. You know what I'm saying? Atlantic ended up dropping us. They ended up like closing out our contract. Even though we had an 8-album deal, it was like, nah, if you guys don't want to go in this direction, then, you know, you could do it someplace else. So
what was the direction they were trying to make y'all go in? Like more of a pop direction?
Like pop. You see us going from the first album with the Timberland boots and just the street vibe, where we wanted to merge hip hop and R&B. They wanted to pull us into, like, when you look at Funny How Time Flies, I feel like the first time we in suits, $3,000 pony jackets and stuff like that. That really wasn't like the direction that we were trying to go in. And us trying to just stay real to ourselves, you know, I'm going to say end up causing the demise of the brand, because the brand is still here. It's bigger than Jeff, Kenny, and Buddy. But as far as being assigned to the big machine and stuff, and, you know, this June, I can't say everything, but this June is going to be something really exciting happening for the brand of Intro.
Listen, you're talking on a lot of things that we talk about on this show in terms of the responsibility of the music executives and really, like, pretty much like pencil necks pushing paper. Like, most of them aren't musicians. Most of them aren't songwriters or producers. Like, we had the pleasure of witnessing the greatness of Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, L.A. Reid, and Babyface, those music execs that were actually, like, musicians and producers, but a good majority of them aren't. So they're not, most of the time, in terms of the black artists that are signed to those record labels, they don't put as much effort into. And you're, all the stuff that you're talking about in terms of what y'all had to go through is a replicate of what the industry would, how they treated artists and how they would handle those albums with artists that were anticipated. Because again, that album, that y'all Intro was definitely, that sophomore album was definitely anticipated. And when you really look back and when you're thinking from what your recollection and what your truth is, it aligns with what happened. That's how I saw it in real time back then as well. Because it's like you're waiting for those that record and that album, that promotion, either via music videos on certain television networks, and then when it didn't happen, it's like, well, where you, and then it's like you're dependent on the radio and you're dependent on that TV for those albums. So in terms of what you see for it, like what's the difference that you see now from in terms of, do you think it's more of the same, or do you think some of these independent artists that are getting some of major label pool in terms of allowing the internet to let the people decide what their success is in terms of how they put out the music. Do you see any difference from how record labels are handled now and today? I mean, from now, from the past, do you see a difference?
That was 20 questions. I'm just messing with you. That was 20 questions. But you know what? But I got it, though. I got it. The difference now is that the artists don't want to leave home because they're making like $50,000 a week with streaming. So why are they going to go out on Saturday night and do a show for $10,000 to $20,000 when they don't, you know, they're at home getting all of this money just from streaming? Like, streaming is crazy. Like, it's some artists that's out there getting like, honestly, like $50,000 a week just off of their streaming numbers. So it doesn't make sense for them. I mean, in the pandemic, nobody can go anywhere anyway, but say pre-pandemic, you know, with streaming, artists started getting more money just from streaming than going out and performing live, or going out to do, like, we need you to go out and do a promotional tour. Promotional tour? What? I'm not going out doing a promotional tour for free when I'm sitting at, I could sit at home and get, you know, get these bags right here. So that's the difference. Right. Yeah, it's like the whole money game has changed. It's like these young artists are really killing it. They're getting it. It's like it's a whole different. Streaming has created like a whole different element to the game. Like, we would have to wait for 4 months, see how many CDs we sold for them to account for, and then to like send us a check. Now, like, you're seeing your thing like on a weekly basis, like the graphs, you know what I'm saying? Almost like the stock market graphs. But it's a lot more music out there. A lot more money out there. Like with so much music and stuff out there, with so much music out right now, it also creates like a lack of attention because you don't know where to look. You don't know, like, nobody has their favorite groups. Like when I was coming up in the game, I had my favorite group. Like, my favorite group was Tony. You know,
right.
Now, with music today, it's like it boils down to having a favorite song. Like, who's my favorite? What's my favorite song?
Right.
Then those are my favorite.
You sound so business minded. I wanted to get to, I guess I only got a couple more questions and before we wrap up. But in terms of, because you sound so business minded, what was anything that you learned? What was it something that you can reflect on when you were younger in the group to what you now, that you apply now, like what you did differently? like, going forward in terms of business?
Well, one of my biggest lessons was rocking with Kenny when we did the Mary J. Blige joint. It's like, we was like, okay, you're going to be the writer on these songs because we're going to get a publishing deal, and then we're going to do another batch of songs that I'm going to write on, and we're going to get another publishing deal. And that was our plan. And then the very first publishing deal that we did with James over at MCA, I think he gave us like something like $70,000, like in one day. And we was like, that wasn't enough. Like, we're not doing no more publishing deals. Like, we took the check, but had we not took the check, like, that $70,000 would have been like $240,000 a month later. So we was like, all right, now, okay, so I learned just from moving in it, like, to not do certain things and just hold on to my own. Like, from that situation, I learned, like, not to sell my publishing and just create my own publishing company. And no matter how slow the money moves and how long it takes to come in, just wait for it. Like, don't go for the big check. Like, get what's yours. Do, like, ownership. Like, Tyler Perry, the reason why he's so successful is that he owns everything. Try to own as much as you can. You know, don't go for the smoke and mirrors. Like, you know, like, we fell for the biggest checks that we ever seen before. Then, wow. You know, like, a lot of artists will do it. They'll fall for that big check right at the beginning, and then once they get it, and then they'll notice, like, wow, I shouldn't have took it because it's nothing but a high interest loan. I should have just waited and just earned my money, like, organically. So, the advance money and all of that stuff, like, a lot of artists, they just want to be signed to a label. They just want to, I just got to get a record deal. Just want to get a record deal. At the bottom of the day, I'm not trying to discourage anybody. Like when we did it back then, I think it was more of a dream of having a record deal and stuff. When it happened for us, we weren't really expecting it. But nowadays, it's no more of a dream. It's pretty much, there's a system to it. Anybody that's a musician can be an artist that's signed to themselves, get a distribution deal, or, you know, whatever distribution that's out there. You know, you got so many distribution companies out there. I don't want to name one. They have so many distribution companies where they can upload their songs. They can purchase their own ISRC, International Standard Recording Code. That's a big deal right there because that's your social security number for your song. I would advise all artists that's putting out their own music, don't just drop your music into the distribution, but purchase your ISRC codes. You can get like 100,000 of them for like $100. It's called the International Standard Recording Code. And no matter where that song goes, if they use it in television, if they use it in film or their commercials, whatever, that ISRC code will direct whoever is trying to purchase your music or license your music to you and not to the person who you linked it to, i.e. the record company, distribution company, or whatever. It links it back to the actual creator of the song. So that's just the advice that I would give. Sorry for being so long-winded.
No, you're good, man. That was perfect. This is only, I only got one more question, and I'm going to play this game with you that we do on the show. But before that, this is personally for me, because I'm telling you, like, Intro's first debut album is one of my favorites of all time. And I just need to know personally for me, in terms of the chord progressions, like the whole, I guess it's mostly centered around like, in terms of the keys, the chord progressions in the songs. Like, what did you play? What was the songs that you played debut album? Oh, you didn't play any of those?
I produced a demo to get us the record deal. But
right.
Once we got the record deal, it was a production deal.
Okay.
I didn't sign on as a producer. I was offered a contract to sign on as a producer, but I didn't want to be tied in as an artist and a producer to the same company. So I just stayed on as an artist. So we had like the, you know.
That's why I just see you on the co-written. Okay. I was curious about that because I was wondering.
On the second album, I wanted to produce a record. And like I said, I went into the meeting with the A&R when he pulled the bat out on me. He was like, yo, you think you as talented as Kenny Uses and that? I was like, all right, what do we got? He started playing records for the second album, and I heard the Rodney Jerkins record, Strung Out on Your Love. So that was the last slot available. So that was my chance right there on producing on the intro record. So now, fast forward to 2021, now I have the opportunity to produce like 4 songs on this upcoming album right here. So I'm putting my best foot forward and, you know, like on the next album that's coming out on the soundtrack, I actually get a chance to be, to produce some music on it, to take it back to day one. I'm also, executive producer on the documentary as well with, Jason Evans from Endaflix Film. So, let's just see, you know, everybody that's listening, thank you for feeding my family for over 25 years. You know, I'm always going to put my best foot forward. Shout out to, rest in peace to Kenny Green. Shout out to Jeff Sanders, who recently said he don't want to do it no more, and he's retiring and this and that. You know, I always felt like intro is bigger than the members that's in it. I'm just doing my part to keep the brand moving forward.
Hey, amen. I definitely feel you on that. Yeah, to me, I feel like you're hitting on everything. What's right? What you said in terms of that documentary? What I'm curious on in terms of, I guess just the creative process of how y'all got together, and I guess that'll be unfolding in the documentary. But in terms of the documentary, what is it that you want to? In terms of the intro legacy, what is it that you want people to know about intro? You know, overall.
Mm-hmm. With the passing of Kenny, I always wanted the legacy of intro to not be that intro died once Kenny died. So I always wanted to keep that going. So I put other people in the group. At one time we had like 4 people in the group, but it never really worked out. We always end up, they always wanted to fight me and stuff like that. But my whole thing was, it's like, I wasn't mean, but I mean, business wise, I'm shrewd. I just wanted to uphold the integrity of intro, and I wouldn't do anything that Kenny wouldn't do. So a lot of times they would come in the group trying to be the reincarnation of Kenny Green and stuff like that. I'm like, yo, just get in where you fit in and blah, you know. So my thing is, I didn't want intro to die with Kenny, with the passing of Kenny. There's a lot of information as far as the creation of the group, as far as what went on with us during the whole time from us signing the deal to us going on tour, to us coming back home from off a tour, family, dealing with family stuff, and, you know, a lot of that stuff is in the documentary. Like, the first time I watched the first draft of the documentary, I cried like 3 times, and my 5-year-old daughter caught me crying. She came down into the studio and caught me crying, and she couldn't understand why somebody would be crying because they're happy.
Right.
So,
wow.
So it was
mostly like, and like when you, I guess to sum up intro, like, and if you could sum it up in like 3 words, like, what would you say the legacy of intro is?
Music, lyrics, and love.
There we go. Okay. What? Man, I got, listen, I said that was going to be my last, but I got, like, okay, when is the documentary supposed to be released? You said on June
24th?
June 4th. Okay. And when is it going to be available at?
It's going to be exactly where they can find it. It may be on, you know, I don't want to give anybody a shout out right now, but it's going to be easy accessible because there's no content that's out right now because production has shut down because of the whole COVID situation. But we have been working on a documentary prior to it. So we have a whole lot of really, really good options right now of where the song is going to go. It is not even going to come down to a bidding war or anything like that. It's going to go down to, like, you know.
Right. Oh, I can't wait for it. I'm a big fan of documentaries because I feel like musical knowledge, I feel like it should continue on. Like it's something like you pass down to generations, like with newer artists and just anybody that's a student of music should always be looking forward to documentaries. I feel like Intro definitely deserves one. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. And the only thing else, the question I have before we play this game is in terms of Kenny Green's legacy. What's something that people in public eye wouldn't know about Kenny in terms of who he was as a human being?
He's a big kid. He liked to have fun. Big kid. Loved to have fun. Video games, chilling out, hanging out. Didn't take too many things too serious. He could overcome crisis really quick and not let it trouble him. Great brother. Great, great brother.
Wow. And I'm going to play this game with you real quick. I don't want to hold you up too much, but it's this game we play on the show. It's called the What's Wrong With You game. I'm going to explain the rules. It's kind of, get confused. It's basically an either-or game, like an artist comparison, and you're basically picking the artist you play more on your playlist, whatever, your personal playlist or on Spotify, whatever. And so I'm going to start off just like this, Marvin Gaye or Teddy Pendergrass?
Marvin Gaye.
The OJs or the Whispers?
Whispers.
Prince or Rick James?
Prince.
There you go. Those are all, again, this game is, I make up the rules as I go. I should have told you that. So those were all bonus questions. So either way you would have went with it, you would have got it right. And now we at like the roller coaster point where I done took you up top and now we about to go all the way down. And it gets kind of intense because you got to get all these right or you get a What's Wrong With You. And so no pressure, I'm just saying. Okay, this one is Michael Jackson's.
The game is rigged.
It's not rigged at all. That's our producer, Will Brown. He's making
up
stuff. Ignore everything he just said. He's making up stuff.
Hey, bro, what's happening?
It's not rigged. It's not rigged.
I'm telling you, bro, I'm looking out for you, okay? The game is rigged.
All right. It's
nothing rigged about this game. Listen, we'll get to the next one. Is Miss Patty or Aretha?
Miss Patty.
There we go. You didn't get What's Wrong With You on that one. You're talking right. Okay, the next one is Babyface or Brian McKnight?
Babyface.
There we go. Okay, this is a bonus. So I don't know where you may go on this one. I think I may have an idea, but I'm going to say it anyway. Mary J. Blige or Faith Evans?
Mary J. Blige.
Oh, my God. What's better? Her debut album, What's the 411, or Faith Evans' Faith album?
Faith album was better than What's the 411, but Mary J. Blige has the longevity and the rock.
Okay, so who are you picking on the sophomore album, My Life or Keep the Faith?
That's tricky, but I'm still gonna rock Mary. And me and Faith me and Faith are really good friends. I'm probably closer with Faith than I am with Mary.
Okay, listen, you answered the right way because people get the bonus question wrong. They're supposed to say Mary's debut album is better and Faith's sophomore album, which I can take, or Mary J. Blige's sophomore album. I had it wrong in my head. Faith's first album is the best one, and Mary's second album is the best. Even though What's the 411 is just like a masterpiece, but in terms of like track for track, like you gotta go with that. So you actually get bonus points. You're
Faith's
the first one to get bonus points.
Faith's first album was crazy. That was from top to bottom.
Yeah. Yes, you thought, and I've concluded, listen, that was quick and easy. I thought I was going to have to deduct points because that's what I do sometimes because I make up the rules as I go. But I didn't have to do that with him because he was talking right. And so I've concluded that there is nothing wrong with Mr. Buddy White. Ain't nothing wrong with him. He won the game. Thank you so much for playing. You played the game correctly. And yeah, man, it was a fun time. I enjoyed this interview. And where can people find you on social media?
Buddy White music. Like today, like it's crazy. Like I wasn't getting out of bed today until I shut down my Facebook, because you know you have to have like 5,000 friends on Facebook before you're not allowed any more requests. I had like 4,991 or something like that. I was like, I'm gonna just start sending out random friend requests so I don't have to pay attention anymore for the time. So I could direct people to my website, which is buddywhite.com, and just, you know, I'm on Clubhouse. I love Clubhouse. Buddy White music. Just simple. All is simple. So anybody Google me and stuff like that, it's going to pop up. I'm telling you, there's nothing exciting about me right now. From June, I'm telling y'all, it's going to be crazy. Like, I'm hoping everybody that's listening right now will join us at our screenings, support the documentary. Okay. Shout out to Jason Evans at Endaflix Films. He did a phenomenal job. And I want to thank you guys for allowing me to be on your platform tonight. And it is great.
Yeah. We appreciate you. Say it again.
That's it. That's all I was saying.
Okay. No, I'm glad you came on the show. I appreciate you coming on. And I think, if anything, you're describing the group, and I love the backstories of hearing how people came together, especially groups. Most of the time it's singers, like solo singers, but I love hearing groups that were together when it was a thing before it started phasing out in the 2000s and 2010s. But I feel like Intro is that group. Like when you talk about 90s groups, you have to mention Intro, because I feel like even with all the lack of promotion and all the things that A&R dropped the ball on at Atlantic with the second album, but I feel like looking back now, just reflective, I feel like it just stands the test of time. I think all the music that y'all did together as a group, and how your story coming together with Kenny Green, how y'all all formed as a group, you and Jeff Sanders, and how y'all all came together, I feel like is a classic story, and I feel like it's all divine order in present time. If you just really listen to your story, I feel like it's all divine time. And all of y'all's journeys, crossing paths, was meant to happen, supposed to happen, and I'm looking forward to the documentary that comes out in June. And also, because I'm going to support it, I'm going to watch it, I'm going to review it, I'm going to talk about it, I'm going to keep promoting it when it comes out. And also, you know, we're going to be celebrating the debut album Intros is March 16th, 1993. We're definitely going to be celebrating that album again on Soul Sadness Radio. Going to be playing all the album cuts from that album too next month. So just to let listeners know about that. But I appreciate you coming on, man. It was a great time, and I'm looking forward to all the things that you have going on. I know you're in your downtime now because of COVID, but I'm looking forward to the summertime when you drop all this. Everybody's going to be into it. Thank you so much, man. We appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate y'all.
No problem. And we're going to go to break real quick. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
you know I try to find the words to say I love you, but I lose control and I know.
Without you, lost without you, love.
Studio W, the Soul 70 Show, right here on The Buzz. Hey, guys and gals, you can check out the Soul 70 Show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 7 o'clock on the East, 6 Central, and 5 Mountain Time.